Topic number two. According to the schedule announced by NASA several months ago, today was supposed to be the launch day for America's second space shuttle flight. But once again, the space shuttle has suddenly started encountering new delays. The first delay was announced several weeks ago when the shuttle was rolled out to the launch pad at Cape Canaveral, Florida. The rollout took place on August 31, 5 days behind schedule. NASA spokesman said that the launch date was being moved back from September 30 to October 9. No big deal, they said, just a few minor bugs to be worked out. For the next few weeks, occasional news reports from the Kennedy Space Center continued to assure us that all was well with the shuttle. Then came September 22nd, and suddenly everything changed. We were told that just past midnight the previous night, an accident had occurred on the launch pad. Supposedly, the mishap took place while the control rockets in the nose of the space shuttle were being fueled up. NASA spokesman said that nitrogen tetroxide oxidizer was spilled on the outside of the shuttle, affecting several hundred of the critical thermal tiles. Those life and death tiles, my friends, are stuck to the shuttle with glue, and it was said that 60 or 70 of them fell off after the leak took place. In addition, perhaps 250 more tiles would have to be removed to check them for damage. Suddenly, the October 9 launch date went out the window. As of now, NASA says that the launch will probably take place in late October or early November. But, my friends, don't hold your breath waiting for that. These last-minute delays of the second space shuttle launch are the result of important divisions within the space shuttle program. If those divisions and arguments are not resolved soon, there will be still more delays. To understand what is happening right now at Cape Canaveral, it's necessary to remember what has happened up to now with the space shuttle. To begin with, it's essential to understand that the space shuttle is a military program wearing a civilian disguise. All kinds of potentially fascinating and viable scientific space missions have been scrapped by NASA. Everything is being cut to the bone except the space shuttle program. Right now, NASA is trying to cancel a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to intercept and study Halley's Comet in 1986. But at the same time, NASA is also talking about building a fifth space shuttle, just to have a spare on hand. The reason the space shuttle is so crucial is that it is America's only hope for regaining military use of space. Up until 4 years ago this month, the United States had a secret military stranglehold on space. But in September 1977, the Soviet Union began a surprise offensive in space to change all that. And change it they did. The decisive turning point came on September 27, 1977. On that day, the secret American military moon base in Copernicus Crater was put out of action. That was the outcome of history's first true space battle, the Battle of the Harvest Moon. It was a battle of beam weapons, and it took place in secret. And yet, it was the most decisive battle of the 20th century. Because from that moment on, my friends, Russia began seizing total control of the military use of space. When those secret events took place 4 years ago, the space shuttle program froze in its tracks. The hardliners then in control of the Kremlin had slammed shut the military door to space. Soon we started hearing excuse after excuse for delays in the space shuttle. Especially, there were all those stories about problems with the thermal tiles of the shuttle. Years passed, and the shuttle stayed grounded. Meanwhile, America's military capability in space withered. In October 1977, Skylab was shot down by a Russian Cosmos interceptor. Skylab had been a vital way station in America's secretly continuing moon program. By destroying it, Russia made sure that America's eviction from the moon was permanent. Meanwhile, the Russians themselves began landing on the moon without public fanfare. For nearly 4 years now, Russian beam weapons have been stationed on the moon, pointed at the Earth. When the Russians shot down Skylab, they did so over the United States. The result was a giant fireball breaking up into pieces. It was seen in half a dozen states from Texas to Missouri. NASA waited a week or so for headlines about the mysterious fireball to die down. Then it began a long, drawn-out cover-up of the Skylab debacle. NASA pretended that Skylab was unexpectedly sinking from orbit. And just for good measure, they also pretended that the space shuttle might be able to save Skylab. It all sounded good to an unsuspecting public. But the shuttle stayed grounded, and at last NASA pretended that Skylab had crashed half a world away over the Indian Ocean. In addition to Skylab, the United States lost its space reconnaissance capabilities to Russian Cosmos interceptors. By the spring of 1978, the United States no longer had any spy or early warning satellites gathering information over Russia. From time to time since then, spy satellites have been launched by the United States. Some of these have succeeded in gathering intelligence briefly over other areas of the world. But as soon as they pass over the Soviet Union, they are always destroyed. As a result, the United States no longer has up-to-date reconnaissance data on the Soviet Union. Without reconnaissance data, my friends, all the weapons in the world are next to useless. America's military planners know well enough where Russia's cities are and where critical military installations were 4 years ago. But without fresh reconnaissance, they have no way of knowing about new targets, which might now be more important. On top of that, Russia is now deploying anti-missile defenses based on beam weapons. Without fresh reconnaissance data, there would be little hope of getting American missiles through those defenses. And so over the past 4 years, reconnaissance has become the number one strategic problem of the United States. There are plenty of other problems, too, because we have nothing equivalent to Russia's space triad of weapons. But without reconnaissance, even the weapons we do have are of little use. The Bolshevik military planners here are determined to launch a nuclear first strike against Russia, come what may. I reported many details about that in the past. I will not go into it again right now. But with that in mind, they have been doing everything they can think of to solve the critical reconnaissance problem. One of their earliest and most desperate ideas was one which took place in April 1978. I reported the details in audio letter 33. The American CIA, working closely with its counterpart, the Korean CIA, arranged for a civilian airliner to be used for intelligence gathering. That was the case of Korean Airlines Flight 902. You may recall it took off from Europe for the United States, but flew into northern Russia instead. It was secretly equipped with special photographic and electronic intelligence gear and flew into some of the most sensitive airspace in all of Russia. In effect, the unsuspecting passengers were used as hostages to discourage the Russians from shooting it down right away. Eventually, Russian fighters did bring it down, but only after considerable intelligence had been obtained and transmitted. The Korean airliner ploy was successful as a stopgap trick, but reconnaissance data can hardly be obtained that way as a routine practice. And so for the past 3 years, we've been hearing more and more about reconnaissance aircraft. Supposedly, these were made almost obsolete for most strategic purposes by spy satellites. But now, they are once again in the news because we don't have spy satellites on continuous duty anymore. One reconnaissance airplane we hear more and more about these days is the SR-71 Blackbird. The latest SR-71 incident took place on August 26, when North Korea supposedly tried to shoot one down. And then there is that famous predecessor of the SR-71, the U-2. It was a U-2 that was flown by the late Francis Gary Powers when he was shot down over Russia 21 years ago. You might think that the U-2 was ready for the history books in this age of alleged spy satellites, but no. Now the U-2 is back, all dressed up and modernized with the new designation TR-1. And its job, now as always, is reconnaissance. If we still had all those reconnaissance satellites in the sky, reconnaissance aircraft would be less important. Naturally, the Bolsheviks here try not to let you suspect the truth about our missing satellites. But every now and then, there are hints about the truth in the news. For example, only yesterday, the Defense Department released a new 99-page propaganda booklet titled Soviet Military Power. It purports to give the public previously top-secret information about the military buildup in Russia. And yet, the booklet contains only sketches, no satellite photos. Why? Because the Defense Department does not have any up-to-date satellite photos of Russia. Our spy satellites are long gone. Up to now, the secret Bolshevik military planners here have been making do with inferior methods of reconnaissance. But before they set off Nuclear War I, they want better reconnaissance data on Russia. They have only one tool that offers any hope of doing the job, and that is the space shuttle. We've been told by NASA that there are to be 4 initial test flights of the space shuttle Columbia. After those are completed, perhaps as early as September 1982, the shuttle will be declared operational. But the fact is, my friends, that these first 4 flights are being used for secret military purposes. The stakes are so high that the secret military shuttle planning team is prepared to lose a shuttle on each flight if need be. Before the Columbia lifted off from Cape Canaveral last April, 3 more identical orbiters were already in existence. They are hidden away in a remote hangar at White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. The primary goal of the secret military shuttle flights is the one I detailed in Audio Letter 62. They are trying to use the space shuttle to orbit a sophisticated new spy satellite to fly over Russia. It's an armored laser-firing satellite designed to survive attacks by Russian space weapons long enough to radio back reconnaissance data. After that, the Bolsheviks here will be ready to set off the American nuclear first strike against Russia. In order to carry out reconnaissance over Russia, a spy satellite has to fly far to the north. That kind of orbit is far different from that which is publicly claimed for the space shuttle. As a result, a shuttle returning to Earth after deploying a spy satellite is unable to land at the advertised time and place. Instead, the shuttle we see taking off from Florida is scheduled to land out of our sight at a secret location in Western Australia. That is, if it survives the flight. Meanwhile, a different shuttle, the Training Shuttle Enterprise, is shown on TV landing right on schedule at Edwards Air Force Base. When the Columbia blasted off from Florida last April, it was attacked and destroyed by Russian space weapons, as I detailed in Audio Letter 64. But the Training Shuttle Enterprise, relabeled Columbia, thrilled the public by racing in from the sea and landing in California. The covered exit vehicle was wheeled up, and it was made to appear that astronauts Young and Crippen walked out. The public perception was maintained that the mission had been a success, but it was actually a catastrophe, even worse than the Bolsheviks here had thought possible. The military shuttle planners were thrown into disarray over what to do next. In Audio Letter 65, 3 months ago, I described their disagreements and what they finally decided to do. After delaying for a week or so, they sent the Training Shuttle Enterprise to Florida in order to buy some time. It is the Enterprise, a training shuttle not intended for orbital flight, that is now on the pad at the Kennedy Space Center. When the secret military shuttle team sent the Enterprise to Florida, they were planning to use it in an intentionally aborted launch. That is, their plan has been to launch the Enterprise, then let one of its engines shut down early. That would lead to a return of the Enterprise to Cape Canaveral only minutes after its takeoff. By staging this show, the shuttle planners were expecting to keep the program alive in the public eye. Meanwhile, they would use the time to make modifications to the next shuttle mission plan to give it a better chance of success. As it stands now, the shuttle Enterprise is still programmed for an artificial abort shortly after takeoff. But the arguments among the shuttle planners, which I reported last June, have multiplied during the summer. Several members of the group are getting very cold feet over the deliberate abort plan. They're saying, suppose something we don't plan causes real damage to the Enterprise. Suppose Ivan decides to blow it out of the sky even though it is still in camera range. We have to have the Enterprise for the public return segment after each mission. What if we lose it? Other shuttle planners are expressing a completely different worry. The second group is not worried about the Russians shooting down the Enterprise because it will pose no threat to Russia. What they are worried about is the public relations impact of an aborted takeoff. It has even been suggested that a full orbital launch of the Enterprise ought to be considered. The Enterprise could not do anything once it got into orbit because the cargo bay is occupied by special fuel tanks. But the viewing public would never know that, thanks to the simulation films which could be broadcast. And as for reentry, the Enterprise is covered with the same system of thermal tiles as the standard shuttles. The first group say that that plan is not good because those tiles still have never been proven in full-fledged reentry from orbit. The Columbia was supposed to do that last April, but it never got that far. The Enterprise might get past the Russians only to disintegrate on reentry. And that, say the worriers, would be impossible to hide. It would stop the program. Out of all those arguments and others like them, only one consensus has emerged. The only purpose of sending the Enterprise to Florida was to buy time. Meanwhile, one of the three secret shuttles at White Sands is now being modified for the next mission. All NASA cares about doing now is to continue to buy time with the Enterprise for a while longer. Then somehow it will have to be returned to White Sands, and the new shuttle will have to be brought to the Cape. And so, for the moment at least, the Enterprise is being used to buy time through launch delays instead of an aborted launch. For 3 years, stories about the thermal tiles of the shuttle were used as an excuse for the prolonged grounding of the Columbia. Now, NASA is trying once again to buy time. And once again, an alleged problem with the thermal tiles is being used to explain away delay. We're told that there was a rocket fuel leak in the dead of night, and some of the tiles came off. Only when NASA is sure what to do next will the latest tile fiasco quietly go away. Topic number 3. 2 days ago, the week began with bad news from the stock exchanges of the world. Investors abroad were convinced that stocks on Wall Street were about to take a plunge, and they were trying to get out ahead of that. When the markets opened later in New York, at first they did drop fast. But the stock market manipulators here are not quite ready yet for a full-fledged stock market crash. So the New York markets abruptly turned around and headed up. By the end of the trading day, the manipulators had driven the market up to an overall gain for the day. A worldwide stock market panic was postponed on Monday. Even so, the experience has given public proof of the instability of the stock market today. 2 years ago, in Audio Letter 51, I gave a detailed warning of the parallels between the stock market today and that of 1929. the stock market has been crashing downward in slow motion in terms of real value for years now. And soon, the stock market roller coaster will jump the tracks, and down it will go. One of the strong similarities between today and 1929 is the role being played by the private Federal Reserve Corporation. Now as then, the Federal Reserve is deliberately ruining the economy through contraction of money and credit. The excuse given is the alleged fight against inflation. We're told that interest rates have to be high because inflation is high. But there is a glaring discrepancy in that explanation for current Federal Reserve policies. According to official government figures, the inflation rate is now around 10%. Based on all past experience, that would mean interest rates should also be around 10%, about equal to inflation. But instead, the Fed has pushed interest rates up to a 20% range, double the official inflation rate. The fact is, my friends, that government figures on real inflation are lies, and so are the Federal Reserve's excuses for legalized usury. Last month, I described the real purpose of current Federal Reserve policies. Business here is being deliberately weakened and made ripe for takeover. The only businesses which are not being hurt are those of the Rockefeller cartel, which are interlocked with the Federal Reserve Corporation. The corporate fascists here are waging economic war to gain power against the state Bolsheviks in the government. So don't look for any relief. Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker testified before Congress late last month that astronomical interest rates will continue for years. Most small businesses cannot possibly earn the 20% profit and more that is required to pay such exorbitant interest, and so they will simply die. Meanwhile, Rockefeller cartel agents within the divided United States government are pressing ahead fast with another facet of their plan. Last month, I gave an alert to watch for an alleged new gold standard to be proposed soon by the so-called Reagan administration. Sure enough, within the past few weeks, talk of a gold standard has started mushrooming all around us. Suddenly, letters to the editor are being published on this topic, which would have been ignored a few years ago. Even the entity Vice President Bush is talking about returning to a gold standard, and Business Week has just published a cover story in its September 21 edition entitled, quote, "A Return to the Gold Standard, Why Reagan Might Try It, How It Would Be Done, How It Might Work," unquote. So far, the bogus gold standard plan is right on track. As I detailed last month, it would not be a real gold standard at all. It's only a gimmick to influence public perceptions about the dollar and to silence new questions about our missing gold. It's being designed to look good, but it's just another corrupt and cruel trick. My friends, corruption has become the only way our leaders know. The long-suffering American people always give the benefit of the doubt to every new president, and it's always in vain. The same is true of Congress today. The more they legislate, the more the country goes to the dogs. But while they are in office, we try to tell ourselves that surely they must be doing some things in our interest. Years later, after it is too late, of course, sometimes we learn a little bit of the truth. A book comes out documenting the large number of bribes taken by a former president or a former congressman is indicted for income tax evasion. But we always tell ourselves, surely it is different this time. We want to believe in our leaders, and so we rationalize away the lies, the double dealing, and the corruption we see for as long as possible. Our leaders know this is how we think, and they use it against us. The entity President Reagan says we must put our economic house in order. Based on that excuse, domestic programs of all kinds are being cut down with a meat axe, regardless of merit. Spending on warfare leaves nothing for welfare. And yet, most foreign aid is going on untouched. The only exception to that is aid to truly needy countries of the Third World. They have no usefulness to the urgent plans for nuclear war, and so they are finding themselves out in the cold. But foreign aid to help prepare for war goes right on without let-up. Most sacrosanct of all foreign aid programs are the annual billions in aid to Israel. Over the past 33 years, the United States has given over $100 billion in aid to Israel. Those very same dollars, our tax money, come right back to Capitol Hill and American multinational corporations. American tax dollars flow like water through Israeli hands into congressional wallets, giving the Israeli lobby its clout. American foreign aid dollars to Israel are also used to buy American-made weapons of war. Those weapons will one day drag you and me into America's final war, Nuclear War I. If our leaders were serious about straightening out our economy, there are many things they could do. To begin with, they should start telling the truth for a change, instead of heaping lies on more lies. Instead of a falsified gold standard, the scandal over our missing gold should be exposed. As I explained in Audio Letter 60, this could be done in connection with an international economic conference in a way that would save the world's economy. The administration's Meat Acts approach to domestic programs should also be scrapped. Yes, my friends, many domestic programs are controversial. Some of them deserve to be. But let's put first things first. Before we take a Meat Acts to domestic aid, why don't we start with foreign aid, alias congressional aid? At least the dollars spent in domestic programs keep circulating within our own economy. But those squandered on foreign aid do our economy as a whole no good. And as for Congress, if a meat axe should be wielded anywhere, that is where. More and more, we're hearing about employees of all kinds of companies accepting wage cuts to help save their companies. Meanwhile, our spendthrift Congress has just voted itself the right to line its pockets even more than in the past. I say, chop all federal salaries in half, starting with Congress. We cannot afford to let them fiddle anymore while our economy burns. It's time, my friends, to hold their feet to the fire. Now it's time for my last-minute summary. In this audio letter, I've tried to sound a warning that time is growing short, economically, politically, and militarily. Men of ill will and corrupt minds are piloting our world on a collision course with disaster. As Americans await the next space shuttle launch, a greater countdown is underway for Spaceship Earth. One day in January 1986, the Voyager 2 spacecraft is scheduled to be approaching the giant mystery planet Uranus. Voyager will be preparing to send a bonanza of pictures and scientific data to Earth. But by then, will anyone be listening to Voyager here on Earth? The answer can be yes, my friends, if the truth of our Lord Jesus Christ becomes the guiding light for our troubled world. We must learn to build instead of destroy. We must learn peace instead of war, through universal neutrality and noble competition instead of conquest and intrigue. If we do not learn these things, there may be only silence on Earth by that winter of 1986. 9 years after its launch from the blue pearl of planet Earth, Voyager 2 could be radioing signals to a deaf, gray tomb of a world. That will leave Voyager itself carrying the final sounds of Earth on a platinum record as it drifts alone forever outward to the stars. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.